cities, went through little periphery kinds of activities like urban observatories, and has now ended up with another program called Operation Breakthrough, all of which were intended in one way or another to come up with some solutions for these really rather crushing problems in terms of living space. During the last 5 years, there have been, essentially three major reports that have come out from the federal government, starting with the Kerner Commission report, going through the Kaiser Commission and the Douglas Commission report, the Douglas Commission of Building the American City, which I have here, which have tended in very clear fashions to really point up the problems of racism, the problems of building and what the problems with building are. And each one of them, while they've promised something in terms of an amelioration of the problem, have really never come up with something. Urban Renewal has come up with Pruitt-Igoe and Wayne Minor in Kansas City. The Model Cities program has come up with deep frustrations in almost every city in which you find the Model Cities program. And right now, it seems that the great hope is in the form of Operation Breakthrough, which has been sort of touted by HUD and by the people in HUD as the great hope of making this breakthrough on what was called for, 6 million houses within the next period of time. Our speaker this evening has been involved in a fairly deep study of industrialization and the impacts and rationale behind industrialized construction for many years. He has his undergraduate degree in architecture from Columbia, his graduate degree from Harvard. He has taught at Columbia and Cooper Union, and is now professor of architecture at the University of California at Berkeley in the Department of Architecture there. It's a great pleasure that I welcome Dick Bender here and present him to you.
I'm somebody from Berkeley. It's a shame after that kind of introduction to have to put Breakthrough down. But it couldn't come from anybody who was closer to it in the beginning and more involved with the idea in the first place. And I feel that as someone who is somewhat responsible for the idea of Breakthrough in the best Maoist Berkeley style, I should be the first to confess about how wrong it is. No. I really happy to be in Kansas today for a reason that you may not think about very much, but if you're a technology freak, and in Berkeley I'm called a technology freak, coming to Kansas and particularly to Wichita is one of the really great thrills you can have, since I assume it's like most places, the people who live there don't appreciate the great benefits that they have in their daily life. I dug out of the old 1946 Fortune magazine quote that sort of puts it in some context. Fortune wrote in April 1946, "The Dymaxion house at 50 cents a pound has made Wichita the Kitty Hawk of industrial housing." Bet you never realized where you were. The kind of thing I want to talk about tonight, though, really asks why it is that if in 1946 Wichita was the Kitty Hawk of industrial housing, in 1971, last week, Secretary Romney said, "We are now just in the first stage of the industrial age in housing production." And he said, "Before the 70s are over, industrialized housing will dominate the market." If you're a student of industrialized building and you've read Architectural Forum in the 40s, Corbusier in the 30s, Gropius in the 20s, and ad infinitum into the past, you find that we are just in the first stage of industrial building. And something like what Romney said last week, I believe the decade ahead is going to see a revolution in housing construction unmatched since men came out of the caves and started building dwellings. We've had, by my count, at least 8 of those decades so far. And nothing's happened. Well, maybe you're not impressed by 1946 Fortune, and maybe you're not impressed by Secretary Romney. But you really know it's arrived when it's in Playboy. And in last month's Playboy, in the Playboy Forum, I found, as long as houses are individually produced by medieval craft industry methods still used in those constructions, decent housing for the poor will only come about over a period of generations. But the modern mass manufacturing methods and portable by air delivery concepts in housing solve this problem by doing much more with less. So once again, we're on the edge of a great breakthrough. But we've been on the edge of this breakthrough, and everyone agrees industrialized housing is here to stay. So how come we're not doing it? That's all I'm going to talk about. I think we're not doing it because the image we have of what it's all about is completely wrong. We're going in a completely wrong direction. That's why I think we can use breakthrough before we finish as a model of a direction, which we all agreed 3 years ago seemed the logical direction, but which becomes more and more clear as a wrong direction as we go into it. But let me try to explain what I'm doing in terms of an analogy. The problem that we have is what the information people call overload. We have an information overload. And if you deal with information problems and information systems, you know that when you have an information overload, it's a sign that you're due for a conceptual change. And the analogy I want to make will try to clarify what we mean by the information overload and conceptual change. The kind of analogy I'd like to make is parallel to the experience many of you have had. And it's an experience you've had whether you're a student, an instructor, or a practitioner for many years. I want to talk about the filing cabinet and how you work your filing cabinet. But there's a conceptual factor behind filing cabinets and the way they're arranged, and it relates very much to the kind of thing I want to look at tonight. Try to think of the way you deal with your own information system. Maybe you're still in school. Maybe you did a school problem in design last month. You clipped out all the things you could find in the magazine. Saw a little folder that says school. And maybe the next problem is on office buildings, and you've got another folder that says office buildings. I bet most of you have a file that runs pretty much like that at this point. And it's a pretty useful thing. When you want to do a school problem, you look up schools. When you want to do an office building problem, you look up office buildings. A few years from now, you'll be out of school, maybe doing your first house. You'll find that the school office building filing system isn't working very much, because now you have to know about doorknobs, and you have to know about windows and bathtubs. So you start up a set of files, one says doorknobs, and one says bathtubs, and one says windows. And as you get all this information in, as you write your first set of specifications, you collect it and you keep it in a framework that pretty much parallels the specifications that you're writing. So if your practice is more successful, pretty soon you've got lots of different buildings and way more products than you can handle simply. You realize your ad hoc filing system doesn't work very well. So maybe you adopt the AIA system, which is just like yours, except it's more organized. It tells you that doorknobs are 24A and structures 3B, and you set your cabinet up in that way, and whenever you get a piece of information, you put it in the right folder. Still everything's fine. You've had a couple of conceptual shifts along the way, which is still working well within a workable framework. Now let's look at what's happened in the last few years with your little information system. Crane comes out with a packaged bathroom. It's a whole bathroom all at once. It's got a medicine cabinet in it. It's got a toilet in it. It's got a bathtub in it. Which of your folders do you put it in? Do you put it in the bathtub folder? Do you put it in the tile folder? Well, you're clever enough, so you work out the system. You Xerox, right?
You make three Xerox copies. You put one in bathtub, you put one in pond, you put one in medicine cabinet.
That goes along pretty well. But the Xerox bill starts to run up, and the filing cabinet starts to get bigger and bigger. You say, this won't work. It's getting too expensive and too clumsy, and I can't deal with these new ideas in a good way. So you set up a miscellaneous file. That's the answer. So you put package bathrooms and maybe a wall panel that's got a window and a door in it. And a whole series of new products like that go in the miscellaneous file. Well, if you've been working in this way for the last few years, and you go to your filing cabinet one day, it's quite a shock. The miscellaneous file is bigger than all the rest. That's what I mean by information overload. And that's where we need a conceptual change. That's where we are in terms of the building industry today. We've got an enormous miscellaneous cabinet, and all the really interesting innovations that we're dealing with don't fit our filing system. The system we've got for filing ideas and dealing with them doesn't match all these new inventions. What we need is a new filing system, a new concept for how we're going to file things, which takes into account what some of these new products and methods and materials will be. What I want to do now is sort of look into this miscellaneous file a little and see what some of the things in it are. But I'm not going to take the kind of look you can get very easily by looking through suite catalogs or following the magazines. Rather than looking at them from their hardware aspects in terms of bathrooms and wall panels and roof systems, let's look at some of the patterns that new innovations fall into. It's more significant to look at patterns than it is individual things. We can begin to sense where the whole thing is going if we look at that. So let's look in the miscellaneous file, and what do we see? We see a couple of very clear trends. The first one is what Buckminster Fuller has called ephemeralization. You know, it means that things get lighter and lighter as they get more and more refined scientifically. We've all probably studied enough structures to have good examples of that. Take the Greek column and the steel column and a truss column. And as we know more and more about engineering, columns get lighter and lighter to do the same work. Look at the size engine necessary to move a certain number of people across the country, or the size that a computer has to be to do a certain kind of calculation. In almost every area of society, you can find that as technology advances, its product gets lighter and lighter. So one of the trends we might look for in any new technology we evaluate, and that goes for the way we produce whole houses as well as the way we produce pieces of houses, is that if it's really getting better, it'll be getting lighter. Second interesting phenomenon that tends to happen is the way we look at things and structure them tends to change, because not only do things get lighter, but the nature of their organization tends to change. Karl Popper, physicist, has talked about a change from clocks to clouds as a mechanistic way to look at it. But the kind of mechanisms that we tend to deal with begin as clockwork. You know what clockwork means. It's sort of a hard machine with a very predictable way of working. When the gears and the clock start turning, you can tell exactly where that machine is going to be for the next hour, day, years, as long as the machine runs. It's very predictable, it's very precise, and it's the kind of machinery that we've been making for a long time. But there's another kind of mechanism that very often doesn't appear to be a machine to us, but it's every bit as workable a mechanism as a clock, and it's a cloud. Now, if you think of clouds in the sky, maybe it's a little more difficult to picture, but picture some clouds that you have a fairly close contact with from time to time. If you ever watched in the water when a school of minnows go by or gnats flying, that's a cloud. That's a mechanism that works as a whole. Now, we can't describe what any gnat in the cloud is going to be doing at a particular time. But when you begin to understand the gnat and the environment around him, the whole mechanism of the cloud of gnats suddenly becomes a real mechanism, and we can make predictions about it. We can tell something about the behavior of the people in it, or the gnats in it. Watch one gnat or minnow swim away from the school, and what happens? When he gets far enough away, all his fears and defenses begin to build up, and he comes back into the cloud, and the whole cloud moves following drifts of currents and food patterns and things of that sort. Second major change that's happening in our miscellaneous file is that the mechanisms we're dealing with are changing from clocks to clouds, so that the mechanistic clock-like kind of way we used to do things, which involved predicting how things would happen and laying them out so they'd happen exactly that way, is less and less relevant. And a kind of mechanism that says, in an overall pattern based on our nature, each of the individuals in the cloud can be much more free, and the total mechanism is the product that we're interested in. There are lots of examples of this you can think about. Certainly if you follow physics, you've seen the change from Newtonian physics to the, I don't know when they stopped teaching that the electrons rotated around the nucleus like planets around the sun, and started talking about little balls of energy. Much more, the view of the atom we deal with today is much more cloud-like than the clock-like atom theory that developed earlier. So we've got things getting lighter and becoming more cloud-like in their mechanism. And the third thing in this pile of miscellaneous data that's going on around us is involved with this cyclical nature in the way things change. As we start to follow the way these changes take place over a period of time, we find that a certain kind of pattern begins to emerge over and over again. Marshall McLuhan described it in Understanding Media. He described the communication system in a tribal village. Someone beat the tom-tom, and everyone within earshot could hear it. It was a dispersed, generalized way to communicate. It was a very effective way. Wherever the sound waves would reach within the limited area, everyone heard the message. But it only reached the village. There was a time when we could be nice to talk to the next village or father as quickly and as easily as we talked to each other. And it wasn't until we moved from the kind of dispersed tom-tom nature, the telephone and the telegraph, that we were suddenly able to span great distances very quickly. But there was a trade-off involved. We moved from a dispersed to a linear method of doing things. And when we went to the linear method, we made a trade-off. You could only hear the message if you were on the line. The tom-tom, you could be anywhere in here. You didn't have to own any equipment. But in order to be hooked into the telephone, you have to change your life and move near the line. Or you have to pay to bring the line towards you. And you have to have a telephone. That's a big technical progress, because we now have to talk anywhere in the world instantly. But we've paid for it in a sense in terms of a restriction on our freedom. We've become more clock-like in the way we work, in terms for more leverage in terms of the way we deal with society. That's not the end of the picture of this cycle, though, because when you go beyond the linear method of the telegraph or the telephone, and go to radio and then to TV, and finally TV with a satellite, you find that suddenly you can communicate with anyone in the world without the lines. It doesn't matter where you are anymore, because we can now communicate without the necessity of lines and gone back to a large-scale version of the tom-tom. And that's where Marshall McLuhan coined the phrase the global village. We've converted the tribal village into a global village. And in a sense, we've changed our technology from a small-scale, simple thing through a linear mechanism where we solve problems at the expense of constraints we accepted, to a generalized system on a larger scale where we began to free ourselves again. That's another pattern we see through the technology that's developing. One of the points I'm going to try to make with some of the pictures I'll show you and what we talk about later is that where we are in the housing industry today is on the line. We're right in the middle. The idea of a housing factory, the idea of industrialized housing as we've been talking about it, means that we're making a sacrifice in terms of what we want in order to get mass production. We're being linear in that sense. Let's talk quickly about what some of the other things are that are in the filing cabinet. One is a pattern which has become more and more clear in the technology that we have. Put it precisely, you might say that invention has become the mother of necessity. That in fact each new invention convinces us more and more of the necessity of that invention and begins to reform the way we look at the problem until the only way we see the solution is in terms of the invention. That sounds like double talk. Let me give you an analogy. There are lots of them, but maybe the best one is the automobile analogy. One day we were all walking and riding a mule. It was kind of difficult to get around. And someone said, wouldn't it be marvelous if we had a mechanical system to take us around? We had a machine that we didn't have to work with, didn't have to feed, and could carry much bigger loads than we have. So someone invented a car. The car was a success, but it wasn't worth much because there were no roads to go on. So once we had the road, once we had the car, we said, well, we really ought to restructure the towns we live in a little, make some roads so we could use the car. But of course, the minute we built the roads, cars became more attractive. More people bought cars. Once we had more cars, we needed more roads. Somewhere along the line, Henry Ford got the idea that if we make cars cheap enough, everyone will be able to work making cars and then buy the cars, and soon we have lots of cars. And so the roads gave way to boulevards, and the cities got bigger and bigger. And the old trolley lines and tram lines that had structured the original city gave way to boulevards and avenues, and finally when they clogged up the freeways. And finally, as the freeways cut through the city and we zipped longer and longer distances on the freeways, we said, oh, the freeways are congested. There's a lot of smog. Cars are noisy and messy. It costs a lot of money, a lot of accidents. Let's solve the problem. Let's have a mass transportation system. It's too late. You can't put a mass transportation system in a city like Los Angeles anymore because it's spread out so much that the only way to deal with it seems to be with the same kind of dispersed system that made the problem. So you've reformed your shape of the city in terms of the car, and the only solution is more cars. And each step up the escalation, up the technological ladder, each case requires more and more technology. In our saying that invention is the mother of necessity, says that the only way out is to build more of the products. You can't get off the spiral, you have to stay on it. You can take lots of other examples of that approach. You can look at elevators. Land prices downtown got expensive. Buildings got taller, but they couldn't go higher because people couldn't walk any higher. So someone invented an elevator, and then you could go much higher with the building, and therefore land prices got still higher. So you needed a high-speed elevator, and buildings got still higher, and land got more expensive. So finally, it's unthinkable to build office buildings in any city without elevators. You could do the same kind of thing with computers, which made us ask more complicated questions, because now we could answer more complicated questions. And the more complicated the questions were, the more complicated questions we had to ask, so finally we can't do anything without a computer. And the same thing happens in business communications, which let us get out of a little office and spread all over the country. But now you can't have a business without a telephone anymore, or a Xerox, or the whole series of things that go with that. So one of the things that's built in this technology is an escalation, a deeper and deeper involvement. And that sounds pretty brutal if the only picture you see is that it's going to go on that way. The last of the pieces in my inventory that I want to talk about is what Peter Drucker has called discontinuity. And he says that change is not a smooth, continuous change of the sort that we've just talked about. It doesn't continually escalate and go on. But every major change is suddenly involved in major discontinuity. Suddenly all the institutions that we're dealing with begin to change based on a set of inventions and observations that we've had. In that same way, toward the end of the 19th century, as a result of the inventions that came out of the physical sciences in the previous 150 years, an enormous number of new institutions arose. You start to look at the nature of these institutions, it's quite interesting, because in that time, most of the big corporations arose to do specific jobs. Even the cities as corporations arose. Most of the universities were built. And they're all built on physical sciences. There were steel companies and railroad companies and
on the automobile companies, or power companies.
They've really reshaped our lives in many ways. One of the things they haven't done is taken into account a whole series of scientific developments that have happened since the end of the 19th century. Developments in biology and chemistry and the human sciences. And I think one of the things we can expect to see in the next generation, in the last part of this century, is a kind of change of institutions very similar to what we had at the end of the 19th century. And a whole new set of institutions arising this time out of the results of research and development that have come in the biological and the human sciences. What they're going to be like, I can't say. That's sort of the interesting part about being around for the next generation. But let me make this sort of progression more clear with one more example. The corporation that grew up out of the physical sciences at the end of the 19th century, well, they all had names you could identify with, and they had services that you could deal with. They were clock-like mechanisms. So the U.S. Steel Company made steel, and the Pepsi-Cola Company made soda, and the beer companies made beer. And at the same time, there were a whole group of political organizations that had the same kind of clock-like nature. The communist cell was developing in that kind of area. It also had a clock-like structure, had a clear goal, a leader you could pick out, and a structure that you could deal with. Look what's happened to those forms as they move farther into the 20th century. The corporation is giving way to the conglomerate. And now we don't have companies that make steel or Pepsi-Cola anymore. What does Litton Industries do? Who's the leader of Litton Industries or General Dynamics? Where are they going? Aren't those the same questions they ask about the movement? The movement is the political conglomerate of the communist cell. Who's the leader of the movement? What are their goals? All the forces that we're dealing with in business life, in social life, and in science and in architecture are becoming more cloud-like in their nature. Well, the point that I'm trying to make here is that as the basic patterns of technology are clearly becoming lighter, more dispersed, more cloud-like, more free, and quite different from the past, we're beginning to tool up to build factories, to build 19th century houses. And in fact, that's what Operation Breakthrough is all about. And that's what Playboy is talking about, and Governor Romney is talking about, and that's what Fortune magazine was talking about in 1946. Wouldn't it be great if we could make a factory to make a house? I don't think it would be great at all. I think it would be great if we could make in factories something better than any house that we've ever seen. I'll try to illustrate some of the things that I've been talking about. I'm going to show some pictures. I'm not going to show you the kind of house that we could make. But I think I might be able to make more clear in showing you some of these pictures the kind of change that might happen in the way we might expect change to take place over the next generation. Can we have that? Now, that's a pretty unusual beginning, you've got to admit. You recognize what they are? They're bicycle wheels. Four different designs for the front wheel of a bicycle. This was a series of designs that were prepared and shown to a group of physicists. And the physicists were asked, given the mathematics of each of these bicycle wheels, can you predict the motion that the bicycle will take as you ride it? With varying degrees of trouble depending on the variation in the wheel. They solved all of the problems. They accurately predicted the motion. There's only one trouble with that. Let's picture my son. You recognize what he's doing? It's called popping the wheelie. And as a matter of fact, he's not riding on the front wheel. And it doesn't matter what shape the front wheel is when you ride a bicycle like this. And all the physicists' projections become meaningless in the kind of context that you see here. One of the points that I'm trying to make is that while we're doing very mathematical computations on the motion that will derive from the shape of the front wheel, we may very well be popping a wheelie. Let's look at it a different way. You've probably seen this kind of thing many times before. What's the diagram of it? Is it a star? Or is it a group of cubes? Once you've seen the cubes, it's hard to see the star again. But once you've seen the star, it's hard to see the cubes again. The interesting thing is the whole picture has changed, and yet none of the data has changed. There's all the stuff in our miscellaneous file waiting for a conceptual change. You see what you expect to see. And once you know how to organize the visual material, you see the picture that you're now ready to see. All the elements of industrialized building are laid out in front of us today. They may be looking like the star. And one day, with the snap of image shift, we may be able to see the cubes. And then things will begin to fall in place much more carefully. What we're talking about is what we've been calling the view from the moon. But we don't really have a view from the moon. We've been in the midst of an enormous surge of projection of futurist architectures and how technology and architecture will change in the future. There are visions like this, futurist architecture. But that's not futurist architecture, is it? Because there are existing buildings that look just like that already.